Pythagoras once said, "For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seed of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." Welcome to episode 48 of Our Hen House, a place to find our way to change the world for animals. In today's episode, we will give you our take on the New York City premiere of the film Forks Over Knives, which filled up a theater on 19th Street. Joining us today is Dr. Joel Furman, author of Eat to Live. Dr. Furman will talk to us all about nutrition, including hot topics such as protein, B12, and processed foods.
Ew.
For our review section, we will be joined by Ari Solomon, who will review the film Never Let Me Go from an animal rights perspective. All that, vegan banter, and of course, current events from the world of animal rights. My name is Jasmine Singer, and I'll be your co-host today in Our Hen House, along with my peach, Marianne Sullivan. Now please, pull up some hay. Let's get squawking. I'd like to welcome my co-host, Marianne Sullivan.
Hello, my little bunch of kale.
I'm not sure if that's the most romantic one that you've had.
But there's nothing that either of us feel more positive about than kale.
It has been a healthy Hanukkah week.
I don't remember having kale when I was a kid. I don't think kale existed. I think they invented it recently.
It probably existed, but I didn't have it when I was
never
a kid
heard
either.
Of it.
No, I didn't hear of it until I was like 25.
Now it's all over the place.
Well, and is it?
Is it just us?
Yeah, because when we go to the supermarket sometimes and we ring it up, the cashier asks us what that is.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That's happened several times.
It is not sad. But at least it's in the supermarket.
I make the best kale chips, I've got to say.
No, it's true.
Like cheesy kale chips. They're made with tahini and kale.
They're insane.
They're so good. I feel like every kid should eat them. I'm going to start making kale chips for all the kids.
All the children in the world.
All the children in the world. I made that song up. I was going to make a kale chip song for kids. That wouldn't work, would it?
So I don't think so.
How Hanukkah's over.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to believe. I don't know what's going on this year.
No.
Hanukkah came and went.
It came and went.
It was a blur.
I got some great gifts.
We at least lit candles every night.
We did. You're very good at the Hebrew prayer.
Oh, well, you know, I would kind of like to know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's pathetic.
I grew up Reformed Jew, you know, I was bat mitzvah and everything. I'm totally...
Would you like to know what you're saying?
Totally not religious right now. I'm like the antithesis.
Yeah, we all know. You say this
religious.
Every day.
But I did the prayers over the menorah mainly to make my grandmother happy, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm saying.
I like traditions like that, regardless of whether, you know, belief in the nature of the universe goes along with it, but when I'm reciting a prayer, I kind of like to know what it's saying, you know, just in case.
You know what it's saying? It's saying, don't get Marianne a shower cap. Because
but you didn't listen. God told you, and you didn't listen. What's wrong with you?
We get gifts for each other for Hanukkah, and
some are bigger than others,
right? And most of them are on the smaller side. We get like one big gift. And your big gift was tickets to Pee Wee Herman on Broadway.
Oh, I can't wait.
Pee Wee Herman on Broadway.
I love Pee Wee Herman.
And he's on Broadway. And we're seeing
poor Pee Wee Herman. He is a man who really is a brilliant comedian,
in my
humble opinion. And just what a ridiculous end to a career.
Right. Well, I'm glad that gift worked out because the shower cap didn't.
Yeah, well, presumably the tickets cost more than the shower cap.
Right.
It's a really, really cute shower cap.
It's
probably the cutest shower cap I've ever seen. I've never used a shower cap in my life.
It's got
and
a
I
big
probably
daisy
won't
on it.
Start.
You take baths.
And I didn't say anything. You just
assumed
come on.
I couldn't help it.
You
started crying. So, you know, we can't always win.
I feel
win.
Bad.
Yeah,
feel
well,
bad.
You know, you did
it
get...
It was very pretty.
I'm just saying
and
that
it looked good on Rose.
You got me dish towels.
Yeah, I know.
I'm
well, dish towels you can use. I mean, have you ever used a dish towel? Every single day of your life. Have I ever used a shower cap? Not once.
Well, you know, never too late to try to start.
I don't like using a shower cap.
All right,
it's like your head feels all encased in plastic. You don't feel like you really took a shower.
It's not a shower. It's for the bath. Like, okay, never mind. You know what? Let's talk about the movie.
Forks over knives.
Yeah, we saw forks over knives.
370.
One of the elite.
377 people showed up, with 100 people on the waiting list at a theater in New York City to see Forks Over Knives.
On a Monday night.
Which is a new film that is all about the health arguments for veganism. T. Colin Campbell is in it. And Caldwell Esselstyn is in it.
Yeah, it's really largely about the work of T. Colin Campbell and Caldwell Esselstyn. It highlights them.
Well, I think one of the best parts about it was just the turnout. It was unreal. And it's not in theatrical release yet. It will be in March.
Yeah, they say they're going to have a theatrical release of this movie, which is so exciting. So, I mean, it's really going to reach a lot of people if that happens.
It talked about the China study. It talked about the reasons why people should, plethora of reasons why people should adopt a vegan diet, though they only said vegan in the film once, which was fine.
I think that's all right.
Yeah, I don't
that's
care.
Fine. And it did follow a few stories of people who had been ill.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit here and there.
It was a little dense in the intro. I hope, it's hard to evaluate going in this already knowing a lot of this.
Right.
How overwhelming the amount of information will be for people who don't know any of it. But they certainly make an unbelievably compelling case.
It's true. I mean, it was, in many ways, it was a great film because you and I are, especially you, are fairly obsessed with this topic. And, like, I can see having family members of mine go and see this and be very educated. But it did feel a little PBS-y. Wait, can we just stop a second? I just noticed that that our TV is dusty and you actually wrote "dust me" with your finger in the dust. You wrote "dust me." Wow, yeah. You didn't dust it. You just wrote "dust me."
I just wrote it. I don't know.
Okay.
I couldn't dust it at the moment. I didn't have a dust cloth.
Okay, but back to the film.
Our house needs work.
Our hen house is dusty.
Yeah.
But back to the film. Any interns out there? No. Okay. I'm just kidding. It was a joke.
Can I clean our television?
That's pathetic, Marianne.
That's the second pathetic thing we've done today.
What was the first?
The shower cap.
The shower cap.
There was something I said was pathetic. I don't remember what it was.
Well, but back to the unpathetic film. I do feel like it was a little bit PBS-y. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I didn't really see it as like a movie theater film, but I'm glad it will be.
I'm trying to remember Food, Inc. and trying to remember how information dense that was, or whether it was more storyline.
It was a lot of story.
That was a huge hit.
Right. No, there was a lot of story. This was narrated the entire time it was narrated, which, maybe that jives with some people. I found it a little like, I want to know the story, and I missed some of the emotion in some of the people's stories. I kind of missed their pain.
Well, I do agree with you on that, but I think that that's only because I'm comparing it to Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead.
Which is the best movie ever.
Yeah, the production values of this movie are much more substantial, though. This is not an indie film. Well, I guess it's indie. Of course it's indie, but it doesn't have... It has a feel of a well-made documentary, whereas Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, while very, very well done, you can tell it's done kind of on the fly.
But you know what? One of the best parts of this film was, too, all of the meat they showed in it, and there was a lot of meat showed in it.
Disgusting.
I know. It was, and
that
then
was so
show,
well done.
Then they'll show the amazing plant-based options, like... dish after dish after dish.
How did they do that? The meat just looked
it was
nauseating.
Hideous. Like, they didn't even show animal slaughter.
No.
Because it was not really based on ethics.
It was really the health argument. But there's a brief mention, and a brief mention of Farm Sanctuary.
Right,
but
right.
Really, the entire focus was the health argument.
Yeah. And Rip Esselstyn was in it.
Oh, he's great.
He's, of course, the writer of the Engine 2 diet, and he's...
And Caldwell Esselstyn's son.
And he was there for the Q&A panel afterwards.
Yeah, I think he's a really
he's
great
adorable.
Communicator.
He's
yeah.
adorable. He is, and he's strong, and, like, he's just... He's a great...
He's a manly man.
Whatever that means. He's a great ambassador for animal rights. But
yeah, I don't think he makes
angle.
The animal rights
no.
argument, but
right.
he makes such a compelling argument for a plant-based
yeah.
diet. That
so it's true. He was adorable at the end. He was talking about eating soy in moderation and in its purest form possible. And he's like, I've been eating soy for 30 years and my testicles never shrank and I don't have man boobies.
It was funny.
Yeah, he was really compelling.
He also said he's going to have something up on his website, which I can't wait to see, about how to follow a very healthy plant-based diet on a very strict budget. And he's going to have menu plans and everything. That is something that is sorely needed by so many people, including us.
He said $320 for a month's
That's
worth
crazy.
Of food for two people.
That's crazy.
I know.
It's got to be a lot of beans.
Yeah, a lot of
which
bulk foods.
Beans are like the miracle food. They're not only unbelievably good for you, they're really cheap.
And they're good. And yeah, they're filling. Delicious. Yeah, you could do a lot with beans.
Beans.
Good for your heart. Oh, never mind. So, so health, it's like the health episode of our hen house because today we have your hero on.
My hero.
Your hero, yeah. You have photos and posters. You
have a plastered all over the walls.
That's not true. If you're listening to this, Dr. Furman, that is not true. But she does love you. And Dr. Furman has helped so many people in such a huge, tremendous way, including us, including members of our family. And his, well, he's written many books, but this one in particular, Eat to Live, is really like our Bible.
It really is. And his message is always basically the same. And as he is the first to admit, it's very simple.
Yes, exactly.
So well, let's hear it.
Let's hear what Dr. Joel Furman has to say. Joel Furman, MD, is a board-certified family physician who specializes in preventing and reversing disease through nutritional and natural methods. Dr. Furman is a renowned speaker, nutritional researcher, and author. His work has been acclaimed as a medical breakthrough for weight loss, disease reversal, and prevention. His signature book, Eat to Live, first published in 2003, spawned multiple foreign editions and over 20 reprintings. Due to its enduring popularity, it was updated and revised for 2011. His other books include Disease Proof Your Child and Eat for Health, a two-volume set. In addition, Dr. Furman's articles, case studies, and advice are widely published from medical journals such as the University of Pennsylvania Journal of Orthopedics and Nutrition Journal to consumer publications such as Mothering Magazine and Health Science. Dr. Furman is the research director of the Nutritional Research Project of the National Health Association and on the board of directors of the American College of Lifestyle Medicine. He is also a medical advisor to Whole Foods Market and provides nutritional guidance via week-long immersion programs and in-store lectures. Visit his website at drfurman.com. Welcome to our hen house, Dr. Furman.
Great to be here.
I have to tell you, before we interviewed you, Marianne and I were discussing if we're supposed to call you Joel or Dr. Furman. We decided, like, we have to call you Dr. Furman. And if I feel like if we were lifelong friends, I'd still have to call you Dr. Furman. Like, you're such a Dr. Furman.
You're an authority figure in our lives.
You actually have become an adjective as well. Like, I'm eating Dr. Furman-y today. So I would consider that a compliment, Dr. Furman. So just to start off, could you summarize the basic principles of the nutritarian philosophy?
Yeah, it's quite simple. It's basically four basic principles. Of course, eating mostly whole foods, whole natural plant foods. Eating foods that have a high, paying attention, eat foods that have a high nutrient density, a high micronutrient density.
Mm-hmm.
Foods that, you know, obviously, there are foods that have particular value for extending human lifespan and protecting against cancer. We want to make sure we eat enough of those foods.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to eat those healthy fats that not processed foods. In other words, with regard to carbohydrate and fats and proteins, we want to eat natural sources of fat, natural sources of protein, natural sources of carbohydrate. In other words, we don't want to use processed fats like oils or mostly animal fats. We want to get most of our fat from whole natural plant foods such as seeds, nuts, and avocado.
Yum. I just love avocado. I wish that I could eat that as frequently as blueberries. I really do. Everything is better with avocado.
So to sum up the four principles, they are plant-based, whole foods, nutrient-dense, healthy fats. Those are the four basic principles.
And I know that you've had enormous success treating some of the really scourge diseases that afflict Americans with this diet, this very simple dietary philosophy. What common diseases are particularly amenable to dietary treatment and prevention?
Well, most people, when they think about, you know, eating healthfully, they think about preventing cancer, mm-hmm. reversing and preventing heart disease, losing weight and getting rid of diabetes. And obviously, we just finished a diabetic study that showed that 9 out of 10 people in the series didn't just improve their diabetic control, they became completely non-diabetic. They were able to get off their medications completely, have normal blood sugars again. But you know, that's generally recognized. People say, oh, you lose weight, you get, you know, those things improve. But what's not generally recognized is people with fibromyalgia, pain syndromes, inflammatory disorders, headaches, chronic migraines, and autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis and, you know, diseases like that, ulcerative colitis. You know, the people don't generally see autoimmune diseases respond favorably to nutritional interventions, even lupus And we get, you know, fantastic results with nutritional excellence with these autoimmune conditions. So I'm saying most of the diseases that plague Americans get a benefit from some this degree of nutritional attention to having adequate and optimal micronutrient intake. And lastly, you know, I just had a study published in a nutrition journal that showed that as people eat a diet with a higher micronutrient density, it increases their hunger, food cravings, and the study is called The Changing Perceptions of Hunger on a High Nutrient Density Diet. And we are essentially showing, and this is one of the main principles behind my work, is that what most people think is hunger, I consider a form of food addiction. They feel ill because they are withdrawing from their low nutrient intake, which creates a buildup of toxins in their tissues. And then they feel headachy and weak and shaky and irritable and stomach cramping. And they feel like eating again, and because eating again does relieve those symptoms, they interpret those symptoms as hunger. Mm-hmm. And I'm claiming that when your diet style is modified for high nutrient intake, then when you're not digesting food, you don't feel those things. Mm-hmm. And you're able to comfortably eat less food, and you get put in touch with true hunger, which is felt in your mouth and throat, which directs you now to the exact amount of calories you need to maintain your ideal weight. So I'm saying here that the uniqueness of this approach derails people's food cravings, food addictions, and desire to overeat, and that's why so many hundreds of people, even thousands, have lost more than 100 pounds, and people who have been on, you know, diets of every kind of description, who always yo-yo their weight back up, now have keep their weight off, they achieve their ideal weight, and then maintain it for the rest of their life.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that certainly resonates with us because we've been following your plan for some time. And I know that on your website, drfurman.com, as well as in your books, specifically in Eat to Live, you get very in detail about how some of these success stories are really, you know, impacting people's lives for the better. Can you tell us a little bit about the kind of results you've gotten by people eating a more nutrient-dense diet and following your plan?
Well, you know, that's really the most exciting thing and most rewarding to me as a physician is being able to see patients who are, and clients that have very advanced disease and getting their life back. I mean, just to give you a few examples, I mean, one example is a guy named Ronnie Valentine who is, I guess he weighed over 300 pounds, and he had, first he had angioplasty done. And the I think first he had bypass surgery. Mm. And then four years later, it clogged up again. And then he had angioplasty. Within a few weeks, it clogged up again. And he was literally sent home to die. Couldn't even walk a block on all these different medications. And in Googling, you know, reverse heart disease naturally or nutrition, he drops the 150 pounds. He gets rid of his heart disease. He's out there living life, exercising, running, you know, but no medication, no high blood pressure, no heart disease. People go from literally being medical cripples, unable to walk, to having a full life again. I'll give you another example of a woman named Julia who had, I think, two heart attacks and then who couldn't even walk around her house, who also got rid of her diabetes, her heart disease, and now has a full and active life again. And these little people are so grateful for learning this knowledge because they struggled with tragedies for so many years and undergone such, you know, their life was so tough under the care of conventional physicians who just offer medications and surgical interventions which don't really allow the person to get well. Mm-hmm. And it's really the state of current medical care in this country is tragic. It's barbaric.
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really barbaric when you see how it is, how easy it is now for people to give the opportunity, give the information they could at least make the choice to get well, mm-hmm. as opposed to just put through surgical procedures that are worthless and given medications to take for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
So I think those people with advanced heart disease stand out the most.
Yeah.
Of course, we have so many people with, you know, lupus is a horrible condition that, you know, we've seen many patients make complete recovery. Asthma, people don't think asthma is life-threatening, but when you have asthma, have to wake in the middle of the night to take inhalers and can't take an exercise class and are wheezing every day and constantly taking puffers and can't, you know, and have these people make complete recoveries and being able to breathe normally and exercise again and not need inhalers anymore. I mean, even things like that are tremendously rewarding to when see people's lives change from this.
Yeah, from basically consuming delicious plant-based high nutrient foods. And, you know, in addition to those examples that you gave, which are really inspiring, even less extreme situations can be remarkably helped. I have two personal examples. One is my mother, who went to see you in New Jersey, and she is, you know, very fit, healthy vegan. She had migraines and just by a terrible neck pain,
and she really was debilitating.
She was taking a lot of medicines, and she was very skeptical. And you know, she's been medicine free and migraine free since seeing you. And also me, just recently, I haven't been that open about this on our episode here on our podcast, but people do know that Marianne and I have been doing some juice fasting, and then in between the juice fasting, eating just, you know, a Dr. Fermini type of diet. And just since September, I've lost over 30 pounds, and I haven't been extremely overweight. It's just sort of like Zoftig, I like to call it. But, you know, now I'm just feeling so much better, and I feel very sated with the food that I've been eating. I don't feel deprived at all, which I think is, you know, a big deal. And it reminds me that I, as a longtime vegan, you know, even vegans can eat really unhealthfully processed foods all the time. You know, I live in New York City, where you could order fried this and, you know, chocolate that all the time. So it's been refreshing. But speaking of vegans, I feel like we should address this. There's a myth that I'm sure you're familiar with for vegetarians and vegans, and it basically says that vegans and vegetarians don't get enough protein. And I just wanted to hear from your point of view, Dr. Furman. In your practice, do you find that protein is an issue for vegans?
No, not particularly protein. See, one of the main issues is protein is a very important concept to learn about, because we've been kind of brainwashed or miseducated our whole lives about it, seeing protein as some favorable macronutrient. And in reality, we're finding out that one of the main reasons for our explosion of cancer in the last 70 years in the modern world is the preoccupation with thinking that protein is something we should strive to eat more of. So people actually eating their egg whites and their white meat chicken, we're finding that as you eat more protein of high biological value, that was taught to us, that was favorable for us, we're finding now it drives up a hormone called IGF-1. And the higher levels of IGF-1 are one of the most important promoters of breast cancer and prostate cancer. So what I'm saying here is that protein is an issue to consider, and you have to consider it as why a person should be on a diet that's either vegan or pretty close to vegan, with eating very little animal products, maybe as a condiment a couple times a week or something. We're talking here that you have to be very careful about not over-consuming animal protein in particular because of its effect on the hormones that promote cancer. And other than that, the only issue with getting enough protein would be a person who's eating processed foods all the time. Many are eating natural foods, you know, like green vegetables, like beans, like seeds, you know, nuts, you know, in other words, greens. All these foods are naturally high in protein, but because their biological value of their protein content is somewhat lower than animal-based proteins, they don't have the same effect to drive up those hormones that cause cancer. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you don't have to have the complete biological complement of protein in every meal. Your body cycles cells and stores and recycles amino acids. So the best way to meet our protein is, like other primates do, with a mixture of obviously plant foods. And most people don't recognize, for example, that broccoli and other green vegetables are very high protein foods.
Yes.
You know, so are seeds. And so in other words, protein is not the nutrient that you're really missing on a vegan diet. More, it's obviously things like B12 and, you know, and vitamin D, which is the sunshine vitamin. Other things should be the concern, not protein.
Now, you recommended taking a B12 supplement. Is there anything else you would recommend for vegan specifically, or if we're eating a whole food nutritious diet, is that a non-issue?
Well, you know, there are some supplements you should take to ensure nutritional adequacy. First of all, obviously, even B12 for a person who's not a vegan could be important. And, you know, so B12 obviously is more present in animal products and in things with bacteria or fermented products. But in any case, I do recommend for everybody take a B12 supplement. Also, vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin. Mm-hmm. And being the sunshine vitamin, a lot of us in the Northeast aren't outdoors a lot. And we're, you know, especially during the winter months, and when we're always working inside, you know, so vitamin D deficiency is a legitimate issue in our country where a vitamin D deficiency can increase the risk of serious diseases. It's not particularly a vegan issue. It's an issue with everybody, whether they eat animal products or not, because you don't get vitamin D from animal products anyway. Mm-hmm. And the other issues may be, something like people consider EPA and DHA as fish fats, these long-chain omega-3s.
Right.
And the body can make those if you're consuming things like walnuts and flax seeds and green vegetables. Your body can make those long-chain omega-3s, so you should pay attention to that. And for some people, as they get older, like some elderly males, their DHA status, the amount the body makes, could diminish, so that should be watched too. So the consideration for optimal health, we're not just talking here about people who are vegans, we're talking about people, anybody really, to make sure that they achieve optimal nutrition, superior nutrition. And of course, the major issue in America is that people are deficient in phytochemicals and antioxidants because they don't eat sufficiently of unrefined plant foods like green vegetables, like berries, like peppers, tomatoes, seeds, mushrooms, and onions, those foods that have the most powerful effects against cancer. The main issue with vegans and non-vegans is basically they don't eat enough vegetables. They're eating processed foods like, you know, cold cereals and fake meats and pastas and breads, and they're eating too much grains and not enough greens is the main issue. And they're also getting too much oil and not eating enough of their fat from whole foods like nuts and seeds. Mm. So, of course, it's the same issue here, and that why not? And the other issue is that when you make salad dressings out of, you know, full nuts and seeds instead of oil, they actually taste better.
Yeah.
And we can make, you know, desserts and carrot cakes and all kinds of delicious food that people think they're going to be losing some amount of, you know, pleasure in life or flavor by restricting their diet, and clearly it's not the case. It actually opens up a whole opportunity of delicious recipes you never thought of before that actually taste better than your old diet. So when people really do this and learn the information, they find that it actually opens up a whole new delicious flavors of experience, and it's not a question of losing pleasure. It's just a question of learning a different way, a different style of cooking.
I think that's so true. But it's also true that because people, the food that so many people are eating are so loaded with sugar and salt and fat and has kind of destroyed their taste buds. When they start eating a nutritious diet, it can be unappealing at that point, and they need to stick it through because their taste buds will adjust and will wake up. How long do you find that it takes most people to get used to being healthy?
Well, the first week could be pretty tough. The first 3 days, they feel the worst, obviously. Some people are actually, when they switch over, it's like stopping a drug.
Right, exactly.
You know, so that's something you want to pay attention to, is making a person, let them know in advance, if they're going to eat salads and, you know, and vegetables and eating a really healthy diet, they could feel worse at the beginning, not better. And that goes away pretty quickly. That goes away in a period of a week or so. And then, of course, the taste, the ability of to taste natural, subtle flavors more intensely and to really have taste preferences change, that takes longer. That takes in the 6 to 12-week range, not the 1 to 2-week range. So it is, it's a process of learning a different way of doing it, learning which people are enjoying it, but the actually full flavor comes with your taste buds do get stronger. And as you stop overstimulating them with sugar and getting rid of your sugar and salt addictions, you're right, the subtle and ability of the body to taste sugar and to taste salt improves. So now, even a simple food like a cashew nut has more flavor, or a
right.
strawberry is sweeter, you know, because you're not deadening your taste buds with all those, you know, with high stimulation.
Certainly, I think one of the most difficult things, the most difficult thing is salt. And giving up salt can really make everything, when you're used to eating a lot of it, can make everything taste like nothing. But I was really motivated to do it by what you said about it. Can you tell us how you feel about salt?
Well, you know, I do think salt, like you're saying, does decrease the sensitivity, the taste to salt. So eventually everything has to be salted or it has no taste. And naturally, they've lost the ability to taste the subtle flavors in natural foods because they're salting everything. But the important issue with salt is that as you're healthy and living a long time, you know, you don't want to put yourself at risk of something called a hemorrhagic stroke.
That sounds like something you wouldn't want to be at risk of.
Right. So it's like if you're going to make a decision to eat not to have a heart attack, and you're going to make a decision how to eat to reduce your risk of cancer and live longer, then you certainly want to protect yourself against the later life effects of strokes. And a hemorrhagic stroke is one where you bleed into the blood vessels, can be very devastating and most often even cause death. And that's very strongly linked to the salt consumption in a person's diet. And here's what I'm saying. I'm saying as you eat healthier and lower your heart attack risk and have less atherosclerosis in the blood vessels, your heart attack risk goes down and your risk of hemorrhagic stroke risk goes up.
Wow.
So the people with the lowest cholesterol, with the lowest rates of heart attacks, those populations have higher rates of hemorrhagic stroke if they eat a lot of salt.
Right. That's so important to know.
Yes, because like in Japan, they didn't have as many heart attacks, but they had more strokes because their diet was so high in salt. So people who think they're protecting themselves against heart disease should not feel completely protected against all forms of intravascular damage if they're eating a high salt diet, because even people who have no plaque can have a hemorrhagic stroke due to the effects of high blood pressure due to salt intake, regardless of whether they have built up atherosclerotic plaque or not. Uh-huh. Did you follow me on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
I think that's just such crucial information, because I see so many people who eat healthily still consuming a lot of salt, and they believe that the Himalayan sea salt frequently is better, but is it?
No, it's just all these different salts, you know, whether it comes from Himalayas or whether it comes from the, you know, 5 miles under the deepest sea, or, you know, or the purple rocks of Gibraltar. It's all the same amount of milligrams of sodium per teaspoon. We're saying here it's the amount of sodium you take in that does the damage, not the insignificant amount of minerals that accompany one type of salt versus another. That's basically just a marketing ploy to sell people some natural product to make it sound better. You know, and so salt is salt, and if you're going to eat high amounts of it, you're going to pay a price.
Mm.
So eating natural salts and, you know, and what's the word, sea salt or Himalayan salt, it's still all salt, whether it's soy sauce or Bragg's aminos, we should watch our salt intake so we don't consume more than 200 to 400 milligrams over and above a day what would be in natural foods.
Hmm.
That means the natural food diet may give you between 500 and 800, and you certainly shouldn't consume more than 200 to 400 above that, so you don't push yourself over the 1,000 to 1,200 range for a day. And most Americans obviously consume, 3,000, 4,000 milligrams of salt. They eat, everything's salt that they eat, and it adds up at the end of the day.
So why has the American medical establishment gone so wrong on this issue? And do you have any hope that things are changing?
Well, they've changed on the salt issue, and recently the American Heart Association and most of the current authorities have now recommended Americans not consume more than 1,500 milligrams of salt a day. So I'm bringing that down to say don't eat more than 1,000 to 1,200. I'm saying it's still a little high, but they've moved down from 2,000 to 1,500. They used to recommend people, they used to be in a hospital, put you on a low-salt diet. They used to give you 2,000 to 3,000 and call it a low-salt diet. So things have changed. I mean, the evidence has become overwhelming, so it couldn't be denied, and now they are, finally making some changes there.
But what about in general, just with the fact that, dairy is still talked about with, glitter, and meat is still pushed, and processed foods is all over the place. I mean, what is going on? I feel like we are a country that is just going to, just blow up. My dog thinks so, too.
Yeah. Well, it's not just our country blowing up, it's the world. Actually, the whole world is now aspiring to eat like Americans, because they see, as they get wealthier, they want to eat like Americans eat, and we're exporting American way of eating habits all over the world with fast food restaurants, higher intake of animal products, and of course, that has the effect not only to hurt people's health, but also to destroy the rainforest, to increase global warming, to the formation of black carbon, as we need to produce more meat to feed the world's population.
Yeah.
It's very destructive to our whole world's environment. So there's lots of reasons why we have to protect ourselves, our health, and our world by switching to a more plant-based diet that's more ecologically friendly as well.
And just before we close, can you tell us about the Nutritional Research Project?
Sure. The nutritional, it's so important to produce research that could counter the effects of every research study that's been done pretty much just on drugs. And we want to show people that the things we're talking about on this show, that people's diabetes can be reversed, that people can get rid of their migraines and improve their asthma or their lupus. In other words, reversed heart disease effectively. I mean, because the research is out there showing that that angioplasty, for example, and bypass surgery does not extend lifespan and does not make people live longer. So we want to show people they can make complete recoveries. And the research, we could really change the face of medical care in the world today with adequate research that documents these findings in a much more substantive way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Nutritional Research Project is a project of the National Health Association that's designed to either fundraise into a nonprofit. People can donate, and we can. And this money is obviously going to be used to promote nutritional research to published in medical journals. Mm-hmm. And our first, one of our first projects is the one of, is the reversal of heart disease, documentation of the reversal of heart disease on an ideal diet. So obviously, if people want to learn more, they could go to nutritionalresearch.org on the web.
Well, that's so exciting.
We're very excited about that.
And I just feel like everyone has a right to hear your message. Yeah. Whether they follow it or not is up to them, but they have a right to hear it.
Well, they not only a right, they kind of need to. They have to. We should just sit everyone down and make them read.
And you mentioned before, Jasmine, that you've been so helped by, but I haven't mentioned that I Dr. Furman just saved my life.
He saved your
life.
He
really did.
Yeah.
I was so ill when I went to see him, and he really helped me so much. That was years ago, and it's really changed everything for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for all that you do, and obviously, in addition to everything else, consuming a plant-based diet is the most compassionate diet that people can have, and, you know, just hearing about the health benefits of it is just even more
together.
It all comes together. So thank you for sharing your wisdom with us today. We wish we could talk to you for several more hours.
I know. I feel like we have Joel Furman on the line. Can we just keep him there and talk to him all day and ask him every question we've got?
Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, I do have an Ask the Doctor form at drfurman.com where people can ask me their health and nutrition questions, which is a lot of fun too for people.
Oh, yeah, it's great. It's very, very useful. I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Furman. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Good talking to you.
You too. Take care. That was Dr. Joel Furman. And now let's get right into some news, shall we? The moose had it coming.
Yeah, this crazy story with Sarah Palin is creating quite the firestorm. Mm. On Facebook anyway, and various in the blogs.
Facebook is the real world.
Well, okay.
What is Sarah Palin doing this time?
Well, she killed this moose, or a caribou. Is a caribou the same as a moose? I'm actually not sure. On her television program, which seems to be designed to showcase her killing various animals, which apparently some people like to watch. It's a little peculiar. But then it's just so interesting, the whole conversation that it started, because Aaron Sorkin, who's a television guy, I think he might have written or produced The West Wing. Anyway, whoever he is, he wrote this big Huffington Post piece condemning her and talking about how disgusting it was, which was certainly true, that she just, apparently, I didn't watch it, I admit it, but the moose did not die quickly, and it took several, and she clearly didn't know what she was doing, and the whole thing was just loathsome, and the moose lingered because he wasn't shot by somebody who knew what they were doing. And aside from all of that, he writes this piece about how dreadful she is. Kind of agree. And she actually made the comment, unless you've never worn leather shoes, sat upon a leather chair, or eaten meat, save your condemnation. And, you know, I got to admit, I kind of agree with Sarah.
Wow, that's a first, isn't
it? I know,
it?
Depressing. I mean, not that I agree that they're both fine. I, of course, agree that they're both the same and that they're both bad. Mm-hmm. But clearly, people are very upset by this, and I appreciate that. And they're upset by the nonsense of it, that she did it just for political favor or to get ratings or because she enjoyed it, I guess. She likes killing things. But really, what's the difference? I mean, people eat factory farmed meat, which is from animals who are treated far more cruelly than this poor moose. And they do it because they enjoy it. I mean, for the most part. So, really, what is the difference? Oh, my God. What is the world coming to?
You know, you're not kidding. It really, it's the top-rated Huffington Post story, and I think something like 70,000 people liked it. So
yeah, and all of these lefties are very self-righteous. He's talking about how dreadful it was of Sarah Palin to kill this moose. These people who eat meat all the time and just pay other people to do horrible things to animals. You know, I don't want to be totally condemning, because I think it's good that people are having this visceral response that it's horrible to kill an animal. And hopefully it's not just because they hate Sarah Palin and they want to hate what she's doing. Hopefully it really does upset them. So I think that's a good impulse. But it's just depressing that they feel so that it's so unnecessary to apply it to their own lives.
But back in Los Angeles, in the LA Times,
the best news.
Oh, God, I'm just so excited. Do you think this is because of their appearance on our hen house?
Absolutely.
The Spork Girls, the amazing Spork Girls who were on our podcast a couple weeks ago, landed a front page in the food section of the LA Times called Bringing Vegan to the People. I mean, need I say more? It's all about Heather and Jenny Goldberg, who, like I said, they just did a charming interview on our podcast, and it's about their new online vegan cooking show, Spork Online. And by the way, as we speak, I'm wearing my Spork necklace. I told them I wanted a Spork necklace. They sent me a Spork necklace.
They're so good. Why didn't you tell them you wanted $1 million?
I wouldn't ask for that from them, because that would be a little tacky.
They are great. I bet they're going to have $1 million someday, mm-hmm. because they are really, really talented and they know all about food, and it's just they're so much fun to watch and really, really informative, and I'm so excited they're getting this kind of attention. Yeah. And the article was completely and totally positive.
The whole thing, and it also featured the amazing Dennis Henry Henley and Casey Sahan, who we've also covered. We did a video of them for Art of the Animal, because they are, of course, the filmmakers behind Bold Native, and it's just the whole entire thing. It talks about delicious vegan food. It has a load of tips in it, and they, you know what I liked about this article? They really got the essence of the Spork Girls. They
put in
like a back and forth about them, and they compared it to I Love Lucy, and I'm just
they're so cute.
I love this, and outside of this being great for them, this is great for the movement. I mean, this is huge positive coverage. I mean, what else can we ask for?
Yeah, that was really great. And the most bizarre thing of all is I got a comment on Facebook when I posted it that one of my former students at Brooklyn Law School is their cousin.
That is so bizarre.
Talk about a small world.
Seriously. So Eric Marcus from vegan.com, he shared an article that we reported on.
Yes, in Germany, a court has outlawed the colony cage, which is the loathsome substitute for the battery cage, not as loathsome as the battery cage, but the hope of the egg producers that they will be able to replace battery cages with other kinds of cages that are a little more roomy and have a perch, but still keep these poor animals caged in horrible conditions for their whole lives. Germany had previously outlawed the colony cage, and then an attempt had been made to overturn that, and this court decision basically eradicated that attempt and said, no, we are indeed keeping to our ban on the colony cage, which will be allowed in much of the rest of Europe when battery cages are finally outlawed there. Mm-hmm. I think that's due to happen in 2012, and I certainly hope it does. The egg industry is fighting hard to keep that from happening. So really good news out of Germany, and hopefully that will be a model for other communities and nations that want to ban, which there are movements of people who want to ban cages altogether for these poor birds. And in California, where I know the industry has attempted to make arguments that in spite of Prop 2, where battery cages were outlawed, they're going to try to make the argument that that law does not ban colony cages, and hopefully that will not fly.
In our I Told You So news, fish feel pain. We knew that.
Yeah, it's just a new book that's out stating the obvious. Though I certainly appreciate the fact that the author has stated the obvious, because the obvious obviously has to be stated over and over and over again before people can hear it. But she brought together a lot of the research about what's going on with fish, and certainly they feel pain, and they're far, far more intelligent than we thought that they were.
How do you say this author's name? Victoria Braithwaite?
Well, that's how I would say it, but I don't know Victoria, so I can't say it for
sure. Well, I just wanted to give her, you know, some kudos, because she wrote the book.
Yeah, and you just hear this still all the time, that fish don't feel pain, that fish don't experience their lives. It's nonsensical. And what we do to fish, of course, is absolutely horrifying. And there's a particularly horrifying video on the piece where Chinese cooks have come up with a way to actually fry a fish and serve it on a plate while it's still alive. I love people.
Yeah, me too. So what's going on with The Atlantic?
Oh, well, James McWilliams has put out another piece in The Atlantic. And I have to say, though, I saw a lot of positive coverage of this, and it's certainly a very interesting piece, and James McWilliams continues to be really interesting in his take on factory farming and the food industry in general. I had a lot of problems with this argument, with this article, that other people didn't seem to have. It's a great little piece, having him explore the whole issue of whether, regardless of whether your farm animal has lived a nice life or a bad life, whether it's just wrong to kill them. And he comes out with the conclusion that, yeah, it is, which, you know, obviously I'm all for that. The thing that bothered me is that he keeps just assuming that this is possible, that animals, and he just uses the term free range as if free range is the equivalent of humane, and he seems to assume that it's possible to raise farm animals in a way that actually provides them with really good lives and apparently knowledge free of the what's going to happen to them and painless deaths. And of course, that's just nonsense. I mean, it's an interesting philosophical question whether it's wrong to kill animals even under those conditions, but it's not a question that ever exists in the real world, no matter how good the conditions are in some free range farm or pasture raised farm. They're not completely free of pain and suffering and fear and even the deprivation of pleasure. So I thought it was a really interesting argument, and it's great to see it debated, but I wish he had been a little bit more clear that it's complete theory. It doesn't have anything to do with the real world. This isn't the debate, the real debate between free range and factory farmed, which is bad or worse.
Amen. And that was our news. Joining us once again for our review section is our Hollywood correspondent, Ari Solomon. Welcome back to our hen house, Ari.
Hey, guys. It's good to be here.
Our Hollywood correspondent.
I just love saying that. And Ari, I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but we saw How to Train Your Dragon after your review of it, and you were just so spot on with everything you said. It was such a beautiful movie with such a clear animal rights theme as far as we're concerned.
Well, I'm so happy, and you know, I'm really glad that was the first movie that I reviewed for you guys, because it's just such a magical film. It's really wonderful on so many levels. I'm so glad you guys enjoy it.
And we did, we really did, and so we totally trust your judgment now. And as our listeners know, we do love our cartoons. We do love our animation. In fact, we split up that film and watched it several mornings in a row, so that was nice. And
very cool.
Yeah. So now you are here to talk about Never Let Me Go.
Yes, Never Let Me Go. It came out this fall. It might even still be in theaters. I'm not sure. If not, it'll come out on DVD in another month or two. It stars Carey Mulligan, who in my opinion can do no wrong. Keira Knightley, Andrew Garfield. It was directed by Mark Romanek, and the writer was Alex Garland. So basically, let me give you a little bit of a background of what's going on in this film. It's kind of like an alternate reality sci-fi picture. It opens sometime in the early 1960s, but like I said, it's an alternate reality. So it's the 1960s, but there's this whole science fiction element going on where back in the 60s, they developed the technology to be able to clone human beings.
Cool.
So we open with this, we're not sure if it's a school or an orphanage, but it's these, you know, these children living in this, you know, like a boarding school kind of situation. And we don't really find out what's going on with them until, I would say, halfway through the movie, where we learn that these kids are actually clones of people, and they're being raised in order so that their organs can eventually one day be harvested for people living in the outside world.
Wow, that's fascinating. I had no idea. Yeah, this is still playing at least at the Brooklyn Heights Theater. We're going to have to see this, and I don't even know what the animal connection is. That just sounds really cool. So what?
Well,
go on.
It's just so you have these people being raised for this specific purpose, and eventually they're told, you know, this is who you are and this is what you're being raised for, and they all have to kind of face the reality that they're going to die young, because what happens in this alternate reality is that they take organs from you until you basically can't live anymore. So they use you up, essentially. And it's really interesting because as the film progresses, we learn that they're the last kids to be brought up in this boarding school where they get their own bed and they get their own space to kind of live in, and they get to socialize. And that as this cloning has become more popular, they're basically packing people in to like very confined situations. And you don't see this in the movie, but it's discussed. And of course, it reminded me of what we do to animals in factory farms.
It's like a metaphor.
It's a huge metaphor. And so I thought about factory farms, but then I also thought about, you know, animals being raised for xenotransplantation, which is, you know, where they raise animals specifically to harvest their organs to put in human beings. And so there was this, you know, my mind just started going, and I just saw all these connections. And it's really interesting because one of the things that the film, kind of the themes or, you know, the moral running through the film is, you know, whether or not it's okay, even though these human beings are clones, to raise them specifically for this purpose. Like, the moral debate of creating life just so that you can destroy it,
and it
in
sounds,
a way.
Yeah, it sounds like the fact that it's humans in it will make it easier for a lot of people to wrap their heads around this quandary, because they could relate to it. You know, we're such a human-centric friggin' society that once you have animals in the mix, people are just like, oh, it's animals. We could do whatever we want to them. But was that the case with Never Let Me Go?
We get the sense that at one point, when they're told that you were basically the last kids being raised in this boarding school, it's a really, really interesting line where the woman who is like the headmaster of the boarding school says, the reason why we were raising you like that is because we wanted to find out whether or not you had souls.
Wow.
She says, because you guys are clones and we weren't sure whether or not. And we obviously know from following their stories and their, you know, intricate relationships with each other that, of course, they have souls. And, of course, they're just as human as whoever they were cloned from on the outside. And it's really interesting because it seems as though the humans on the outside would rather look at these clones as things rather than people. And I think it's very similar to what we do to animals in laboratories. We don't want to think of, you know, dogs and cats in laboratories as being the same as the dogs and cats that we live with, because it would raise all kinds of moral questions. And so it's just a very interesting conversation to have about whether or not, I mean, obviously I believe that, you know, animals have souls, and we know that obviously animals have all sorts of emotions and an entire inner life. So whether or not it's okay to do this to them, which I don't think it is, obviously. But I think what the movie does is, because we're talking about people versus animals, I think people are a lot more receptive to the message. Mm-hmm.
I think it sounds fascinating, because I think that one of the most common responses, just not even a thought-out response, but people's visceral response to knowing what happens to animals and to confronting the fact that they're killed for us to eat or for any other reason, they just tend to say, well, they're raised for that, as if we can decide the moment this animal's born what it's supposed to, that its life is worthless, as if that's within our power to decide that. And once we've decided it, then its life is indeed worthless. And that sounds like exactly what's going on in this film.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's the exact same point.
So I have a question. Just judging from the cast, it looks like everyone in the film was white. Is that right?
The film takes place in the UK. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of, I think everyone is white in the main cast, for sure.
I'm just asking because, you know, I could imagine this went on with African Americans for so long, like, do they have souls, that if this was not a white cast, if people would get this metaphor a little more clearly. What do you think about that, or am I just going out on a limb here?
No, it's a good point. Actually, you know, my husband and I discussed that, you know, I mean, this is, maybe I'm going a little bit off topic here, but, you know, the same way people look at gay relationships and say, well, it's not the same love as a straight relationship. I think whenever someone is the other, and you have to kind of, well, you don't have to, but, you know, how people will try to separate themselves and, you know, make it somehow different than them and say, well, they're not the same as us. That, of course, once you do that, once you concentrate on the differences versus similarities, it makes it a lot easier to discriminate against and to basically treat someone or, you know, else however you want to. It justifies that behavior.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this sounds like a fascinating film. I'm excited to see it now. I wonder if other people would think of it like this, with this whole, you know, othering metaphor going on, or if it's just us because we're so used to turning everything into an animal rights philosophy discussion. Do you think that other people would see this film and think of, you know, othering?
I definitely think that there's a huge moral question to be had here. And I think that, you know, granted, we're talking about cloned human beings versus animals. But I think that, yes, I think that people would get it. And I think, you know, I mean, granted, I kind of, you know, live in this kind of animal rights world, so I'm kind of looking for these themes. But I definitely think that if we look at what we're doing right now with regards to medical research, I would find it hard not to see some of the similarities. And I just want to add, you know, at the end of the film, they show, in the film, they call it when you finally, you know, donate your last organ where you can't live anymore and you're basically euthanized, they call it completing. Mm. And when we see one of the characters complete at the end, it's very stark and it's very harsh. And yet, it's so much better than when animals are, I mean, euthanized in laboratories and the way that they're treated, that I felt like that was also just very interesting.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, they kind of gave the clones at least the dignity of having enough space to move around, of being able to form relationships and kind of living life in a somewhat normal world. And we don't afford that to animals at all. You know, I mean, in laboratories, animals are kept in cages. They're not allowed to socialize. And it's just, it was really, it was very harsh, you know. But I think it's a very interesting conversation starter. And I think that a lot of the moral themes that run through this film are the same ones that we discuss when we talk about animal experimentation, xenotransplantation. I think it's, you know, it's all really the same.
I think it's also the same about the animals we eat, because really we're just raising them to die, and not to replace our organs, but for even less of a reason. You know, we're not going to die if we don't eat them, and for the most frivolous of reasons, and yet it's the same thing that we raise them just to kill them.
It's, you know, Marianne, you have a very good point, you know, in that, you know, the animals that we raise in factory farms, that it's almost, well, it is, it's just unnecessary killing. Because we all know that you can be just as healthy, if more healthy, you know, eating a vegan diet versus eating animals. So it's almost like it's all for naught. It's just for people's, you know, for what they want to eat, as far as, you know, what they like the taste of, which drives me insane, because almost any taste that you could have with regards to animal-based foods, or whatever you want to call them, you can find in vegan substitutes nowadays. I mean, there's so many amazing products out there that people can eat.
I know I've had conversations with people who are not vegan or vegetarian, and they find the whole xenotransplantation very disquieting and don't like that idea, and it just seems so absurd to me.
Mm-hmm.
That they feel comfortable killing animals just to scarf them down.
Yeah,
it is absurd, and I think it raises a huge moral question. You know, for ourselves and our own civilization. I mean, you know, health at what cost? You know, I mean, what are we willing to do? You know, what are we willing to give up as far as our own moral compasses, just to, I don't know. I mean, possibly not extend life for another year, 2 years, 5 years. I mean, I don't know where those boundaries are drawn, you know, and I think that, you know, for me, I mean, I would like to think, I just feel like no one else should have to suffer for my benefit. I wouldn't want that. Right. I that's how I feel about it. And I think that, you know, I think that the great thing that this film does is it really asks those questions. You know, how these kids are kind of hidden from the public, and they're not really supposed to go out and mingle with the public. And I think that's for the benefit of the person receiving the organs. I mean, what if you knew that you met you met the person that was going to donate their, I don't know, their organs to you, but you knew that they were eventually going to have to die an early death to extend your life. It raises a lot of interesting questions.
Yeah, well, you heard it here first on our Hen House. Some food for thought with Ari Solomon, our Hollywood correspondent. And yeah, this was just totally interesting. I very much want to see it now to see, you know, how my thoughts are formed after seeing this. And I'm sure I'll have your voice in my head throughout.
It sounds really creepy.
It does sound kind of creepy, but I like that kind of like psychodrama, sci-fi creepiness. So.
Well, it definitely has a creepy atmosphere. It's, you know, like I said, it's very sci-fi and it's this alternate reality. But I think you guys will really enjoy it, and I look forward to seeing what you guys think.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to hearing your next review of the next film from an animal rights perspective. Thanks, Ari.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thanks, Ari.
Take care. Well, that was our podcast for today. Thank you so much for joining us once again. We so appreciate it, and I love hearing from you. We both do. So thank you for those of you who email us. You can feel free to email us at info@ourhenhouse.org. We will not be entering emails between December 15th and 20th. Please visit our website, ourhenhouse.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter if you don't already. And if you like what you're listening to, please consider making a donation. Your donations are what helps us to do what we do with our podcasts and the entire organization. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so your donations are tax deductible, which is excellent. And if you'd like, if you donate $25, you get a free copy of the book 95 from the organization called No Voice Unheard, which is a beautiful coffee table book with pictures of farm animals, and they are giving that away for the first 50 people who donate to our hen house. If you donate $50, you get a free ethically sourced vegan-made tote bag touting our tagline, which is a place to find our way to change the world for animals. If you donate $75, you get both the tote bag and the book. So please consider making a donation. Thank you so much for that. And thank you also for listening. Please consider making a review on the iTunes page and rating us all of the stars you can. So thank you again, and we will see you.